Hello there. It is your old friend Ariel Helwani. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters. It is Wednesday, September 4th, 2019. I am in New York City, and I was telling producer Troy, aka TST, aka Tight Ship Troy, before the show, before we went on the air, that this might be my most anticipated episode yet. We've been doing this for around 9 or so months, this particular show, the MMA Reporters. And I'm so excited about this episode because what I try to do on this particular show is find experts to talk about things going on in the world of mixed martial arts. People who really know what they're talking about. And I feel like we have a really great and unique lineup this particular episode. The back end of the show, we're going to be joined by a filmmaker named Michael Tucker. Michael Tucker directed the documentary Fightville, which came out 8 years ago. And it's about the Louisiana fight scene. And they found a young man at the time named Dustin Poirier, who was just starting his mixed martial arts career. And I mentioned this on Tuesday. My days are all mixed up because of Labor Day. I mentioned this on Tuesday. If you have not seen Fightville, do yourself a favor before UFC 242 this Saturday. Watch that documentary. It will give you great appreciation for how far this man has come. Dustin Poirier has come very far to get this point. You know, that whole paid in full thing that he talks about, that's not some cute slogan. That's legit. This man has come very far, and he has been through a lot, and he has seen a lot, and that documentary highlights a lot of that. And, you know, how rare is it for a filmmaker to find a young kid who then all of a sudden becomes a star in the sport and is now on the cusp of making history and fighting Khabib and could be the first guy to beat him, all that stuff and more. So it's a great primer. We'll talk to Michael Tucker about that, how he found Dustin, what it's like to see him become the fighter that he has become, the person that he has become over the past decade. So I'm really excited to get his insight. That will be on the back end of the show. In the middle portion of the show, we'll go to Abu Dhabi. We'll talk to Mohammed Al-Hosani, who I met 9 years ago when the UFC was in Abu Dhabi for the first time, April 2010, UFC 112. They were calling him at the time Mohammed Rogan, a.k.a. Mo Rogan, and he was a man who got the opportunity to be a color commentator in Arabic for Abu Dhabi TV, and he got the opportunity to call that show, UFC 112. That was his first shot. Well, since then, he's become a host. He's become very well known, and we will reconnect with Mohammed Al-Hosani, who's in Abu Dhabi, who will be working the show this Saturday to talk about how big UFC 242 is and how popular Khabib Nurmagomedov is. I think Khabib is one of the most famous Muslim athletes in the world today, competing in sport today. And so I'm curious to get his perspective. Who better than someone who lives in Abu Dhabi, who will be calling the show, who knows MMA, to talk about all of that? It will be really fun to reconnect with Mohammed Al-Hosani almost a decade later. But first, of course, you know, on Saturday in Shenzhen, China, Zhang Weili made history. She defeated Jessica Andrade. She is now the first ever Chinese champion in UFC history. She beat Andrade in 42 seconds. It's a moment that we will be talking about for a very long time. August 31st, 2019, could be one of those dates that we remember forever in this sport. It's a moment that the UFC has been waiting for. They've been searching for that Chinese star, that Chinese champion for years, ever since they signed Zhang Tietren around 9 or so years ago. Well, now they found her, and her name is Zhang Weili. And in case you missed it, this is what it sounded like Saturday in Shenzhen when she made history.
Ladies and gentlemen, referee Leon Roberts has called a stop to this contest at 42 seconds of the very first round, declaring the winner by TKO and new undisputed UFC strawweight champion of the world, Magnum Chung Wei Lin.
That was it. That was the moment. History happened Saturday morning in Shenzhen, China. And what a great scene it was. And I'm so excited to talk to our first guest because he was there. He was in attendance. He witnessed it live. He witnessed history live. He's one of my favorite people in MMA. Let's go to England right now and say hello to one of the voices of the UFC and all around great guy, a true mensch, the one and only John Gooden joining us right now. John, how are you?
Stop it. One of your favorite people in MMA. You say that to everyone. But
not
I'll
true.
Take it.
Not true. I mean it.
Bless you. By the way, how did your beautiful family enjoy coming to work with Daddy?
Oh, it was amazing. Thank you for asking. Yes, that was a week ago today. The kids, the dog, the wife, for the first time ever coming to my work at ESPN. It was really special. And I know you as a proud father now can appreciate moments like that.
Well, mine's a little young. She probably wouldn't understand just yet. But I do hope that I'm still in some capacity doing these sorts of things in like 10 years where she might be able to. But that was very cool. Yes, it resonated when I saw that. That was really cool. Very nice indeed.
How is she feeling, by the way?
Oh, she's incredible now. Yeah, it's amazing how she's bounced back. And I just put her down to bed and she's so bright. She really is. And in fact, my wife had her weigh today and she's up with the 75th percentile for her weight, which, given the condition that she had before, it's amazing to think that she never really struggled in development. But we are now in the clear, I am glad to say. And what a mad 3 months it's been for the Gooden family.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that you're in the clear and obviously wish you and your family the best. I know how much it meant to you guys to become parents, and it was hard to read, but also very happy to hear that everything is okay. And we are pulling for your family to have brighter days ahead and not have the last few months that you guys have had. So let us talk about Shenzhen, John. You were there in attendance. I'm just so fascinated by the whole scene, the experience that you got to take in. What was it like being in the arena? And I know this is sort of an open-ended question, but like just being in the arena and watching a Chinese fighter become a UFC champion for the very first time, could you describe what the atmosphere was like in that arena when it happened?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I think there was a degree of uncertainty about how many people were going to turn out for this event. There was obviously some unrest in Hong Kong. There was a lot of police, military apparently stationed in Shenzhen as well, because geographically they're very close to one another. It had scuppered a lot of plans for me personally. I had a direct flight into Hong Kong. That then had to go away and a lot of people got rerouted. And then, of course, there was talk about how difficult it was going to be for people to transit from Hong Kong. And people in Hong Kong, a lot of expats that might have been more familiar with the UFC, more familiar with the athletes, may or may not have been able to come along. But very, very happy to say that the arena was brimming. It was a phenomenal atmosphere. They were so educated that they were displeased with certain aspects of fights and then celebrating other aspects. But what a way for it to go down the way that it did. The event really did bubble up nicely to the co-main and main. Li Jingliang, you know, taking out Dos Santos the way that he did was just such a great prequel to what was about to happen. And I'm not sure that anyone apart from the guys in Zhang's corner thought that that main event was going to happen the way that it did. So when it finalized with that knockout, I mean, the place just exploded. And you then had to, at that moment, you're living the line that everyone had been speaking about, and this is going to change the landscape of mixed martial arts. Forget about the region. The influence of Asian athletes, Chinese fighters, that is very real. And as you were saying in your introduction, we are going to remember that event, that moment, that date, because it's just going to be a catalyst for ridiculous amounts of growth. Just one thing before you follow up, because I know I'll forget this. Later on that evening, a few of us went outside of the hotel, which we don't always do, I might add. We're always there for just business. And we spoke to a couple of people locally, and someone pulled up a social media that is present in China. And just a couple of hours after the fight, there were 300 million views on that finish on just this one app. And that tells you about the scale of sport in China.
And that's why the UFC has been searching for this fighter for so long, because they understood the doors that this person could open for them. And let me ask you, obviously there's a language barrier, but I'm wondering if you got a sense for how popular, how well known was Zhang Weili before Saturday in China? Like, did you get the sense that her fighting in the main event for the title, let alone what could happen if she won, just going into the card, was this a big deal over there? Or do you think it's one of those things where after the fact people are learning about her?
I think it's, from the conversations that I've had, I think it's more after the fact. There were certainly lots of fans that were congregating in the hotel, but unlike over here, Ariel, in Europe, the hotels where you kind of walk through the reception, you're pretty much at the door of your hotel room. You know, in North America, you're probably more used to this. If you forget something in a hotel room, it's like a 20-minute round trip. This hotel that we stayed in was magnificent. It was beautiful, but it was large. And poor old Zhang Weili, who is, you know, all of like 5'4", is lost in those crowds. But I think that just as an event, I felt like there was something special. Because again, this is the interesting thing about the UFC and mixed martial arts in general. The UFC, it's a drip-down effect. Whereas a lot of sports grow from grassroots, it doesn't really happen like that with mixed martial arts. It's almost the responsibility of the UFC to create something at the top and then try and underpin it. And we had a bit of that. We saw guys like Sumudergi, who looked a completely different example of himself in his debut. He looks like one to watch at like 23 years of age. So it's this interesting blend of having someone at the top end of the card and then this underpinning as well, supplemented by the recent arrival of the UFC PI in Shanghai. It just culminated so perfectly. And I know that the UFC don't have favorites, but you got to think that in the halls at HQ, they're thinking, well, it could have, worse things could have happened on Saturday night.
Sure, yeah.
For the company.
Absolutely. Like I said, there's a reason why they've invested so much in that region and they have been openly searching for that person. But what's interesting is usually you have prospect who then becomes contender, who then becomes title contender, who then becomes maybe champion. They become a star. In this particular case, you have someone who is almost becoming a champion, and now you're almost working your way backwards, right? Because now we're going to see just how big of a deal it is for someone to become a champion who is from China. She's not, I don't think, a star in China, you know, certainly not going into the event, as we just discussed. She wasn't a star here in America, but now I think her winning the belt, she's on this media tour now in Beijing. They're flying her to Abu Dhabi. We're going to see just how big of a deal this is. Like here in America, there was an athlete who I'm sure you've heard of, Yao Ming, who came over from China, who played for the Houston Rockets.
Yeah.
And he made the sport of basketball so much more popular in China and around the world. Now I'm really curious to see if the same sort of thing can happen with Zhang. The difference between Zhang and Yao is Yao was a big deal before he came to the Rockets. Zhang wasn't a big deal before she won this belt. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But I think that she's a brilliant person to be flying the flag. I really do. I've met her a couple of times now, and I do some producing work at the front end of UFC Fight Week. So I actually get to sit down with a lot of the fighters beforehand and have those interactions in a very small room with only a couple of people. And she's very, nothing's contrived. And she's very passionate about being a female in sports. She's got a great story from her mum encouraging her to be a strong woman and not be bullied. And apparently there's history of kind of domestic violence when you come outside of the major cities in China, and she didn't want that for her daughter. So from very early on, she's had certain characters that have been encouraged in her. And now she's just building upon that. And she sees that it's her message to tell that side of the story and influence young women internationally, but I'm sure her folk at home are very close to her heart. But then other things that I think is quite wonderful is how she's trying to show culturally and traditionally the arts of Chinese martial arts. She really wants Kung Fu to come through in her style and talk about it so that it can then capture the hearts and minds of the Chinese people. And we've seen the way that she trains in Sanda, and I'm going to say it wrong. Someone called me out with how I said this wrong on a broadcast, in a very polite way, I might add. But Chinese wrestling, which they do, it looks like a kind of judo gi that they put on without the sleeves. But she stays true to that. That's still very much part of the way that she trains. She hasn't just adopted the more kind of American way of let's throw in this, that, and the other. It's all very much China-based and Chinese-based. And I think that is why it's going to work so well in developing a groundswell of enthusiasm towards mixed martial arts and the UFC product.
Was this your first trip to China?
No, I did Beijing as well.
Okay, and how would you compare Beijing to, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Shenzhen?
Yeah, Shenzhen. Well, I would say that the air quality is better in Shenzhen.
Okay.
I had a burning in my chest when I was working there.
Wow.
It was quite gnarly. I was quite worried about my voice for the broadcast. And I know it was definitely that. One, because there were warnings about the air pollution when we were over there. But also, as soon as I hit Australia, it kind of disappeared. Shenzhen's also a bit of a Silicon Valley. Everything's like big buildings, lots of lights, a commercial hub. I think being close to Hong Kong as well, it has a lot of ties in that sense. So I'm not sure in terms of the sport, et cetera, how big it is, but it seemed to be more of an economic place. But we stayed in a really smart spot, and the buildings were, if you're into that sort of thing, lots of lights and illuminated buildings as a kind of modern backdrop, a metropolis. It was very cool.
And could you get a sense just how popular mixed martial arts and the UFC is there?
It didn't feel like it was as popular as other places that I visit, which would be Brazil, a little bit of Australia, and then Europe.
Right.
I feel like when... But again, that might be down to just the sheer size of China. In Europe, everything's so compact, and people just tend to fill up the lobby with fans make their way down there. And maybe, of course, in Europe, I seem to recognize some familiar faces. Perhaps people weren't wearing the UFC T-shirt, but they might have been there for that reason. So I think it's younger over there for sure, and the athletes will say as much. But this, having a champion so early on like this is going to be quite something. I think it was like 2012, was it, when the first event in China. They had one representative from China on that card. I think you mentioned him earlier.
Yeah.
This is different now. They've populated that card with a lot of locals, and they're good. Like, genuinely good. They're going to give people problems all around the world. So, and that level is only ever going to go up as well.
Yeah, it's certainly come a long way. Like, when Zhang Tietran fought in his UFC debut, he won in 42 seconds against Jason Reinhardt. And I remember everyone thinking, like, wow, they may have found the guy. And then he proceeded to lose every other UFC fight that he had and never fought again. I think he hasn't fought in 7 or so years. But now, as you mentioned, Li Zhangliang, Zhang Weili, Sadong Yang. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are like legit fighters. They're no longer token fighters. They're no longer, people that they're putting on the card just to try to infiltrate the market. And that's what's so interesting about this. And I wonder what this all means. Like, I think this is the great unknown. And I saw people, and I want to get your take on this because you saw it firsthand. I see people saying, she's going to be bigger than Conor. She's going to be bigger than Khabib. She's going to be the biggest star in the history of the sport. She's already the biggest star because look at those numbers, look at the views. Don't you think that, all right, this is big and the door has been open, but now they have to have her go on a long run as champion? Like, it's not like winning the belt isn't enough here because of the fact that she's almost working backwards, because she became champion and now she's becoming a star as opposed to becoming a star and then becoming a champion. Now we have to see if she's just like, one and done, I don't know if it has the impact that everyone's claiming. I don't know if she'll go down in the history books as the most famous athlete of all time. Am I wrong? Are you getting a different sense?
No, I think you're right. And one thing that from my research, I can't remember if it was the last when I was in Beijing or perhaps for this fight, I know that she actually got a bit of flack from the fans for going to the judges' scorecards on one of her fights. It was expected that she would finish it emphatically, and she didn't. And so I think that comes to mind, because I just think that sounds pretty harsh. So if that's how Chinese sports fans react to their athletes, then I think they need to be winning. And when you consider also the Olympics, China is a massive presence in the Olympics. They are very, very competitive athletes, and there's a lot of investment around that because it matters so much to their culture. So I think that she really, in order to galvanize her position and keep this upward trend of popularity towards MMA, you know, without kind of piling lots of pressure on the poor woman, it does seem like she's going to need to do that in what is one of the most, probably the most talent-rich division that the UFC has for women. Strawweight, yeah. But you know, it really is a competitive one, and you know, Tatiana Suarez is someone who is deserving of a shot for sure, and she poses very different problems to what Andrade does, and probably anyone else that Wei Li has fought. So, interesting fights, and if she can keep going, it's going to be great. And I don't know if you caught the interview that Karen did with Dana, where he said post-fight, WME representatives had already been blowing him up, offering opportunities to her. So she's going to have a balancing act, something that I'm sure she's not been used to, certainly if we're right in saying that she hasn't been anywhere near the star that she is like a day after. How is she going to manage being the star at all of these media commitments, if indeed she chooses to participate in them? And why wouldn't and shouldn't you? You should enjoy these aspects as long as they're fun for you. We, you know, people talk about Conor, and he was able for a long time to be able to juggle that better than most people with the eyeballs of the world. They have a lot of eyeballs over there. They have a huge population. So it is going to be an interesting balancing act for her of how she can continue to train like a champion should and then fulfill these obligations.
By the way, one last thing. Did you feel uncomfortable there, given the political unrest? You alluded to some of that. Like, did you feel uncomfortable?
No. I didn't feel uncomfortable. I feel like it's very different. It's culturally very different. And I was saying this to a friend earlier on. If I had visited China as someone who was going to visit China to taste the culture, take it all in, visit a few places as a tourist, it's a very different experience than when you're on the road working. But just things like I like to do my homework as much as I possibly can at all hours, and just getting food at the right time from the right places, it just helps the process. But in China, because everything's so big, it doesn't necessarily cater to Westerners. And I'm not saying that it should do either, by the way. We should always try and fit in with other people's cultures. It just makes it a little bit more challenging as a business trip, but nothing to do with the political side. I think there were a couple of things that were going on where they'd increase the presence of security, but nothing that I haven't seen before in parts of Europe, if I'm honest.
Well, anytime you're on the call, my friend, whether you're hosting the pre and post show, whether you're on the microphone, and I hope I don't put you in an uncomfortable spot, I think they're underusing you. They need to use you more, whether it's you and Dan Hardy. I don't care. I want to hear more of John Gooden on my broadcast. So anytime you're on the call, I know it's going to be a classy broadcast. It's going to be a professional broadcast. You're well-researched. You take pride in your work. You love the sport. And you did another great job on Saturday in China. And great to get your perspective. It was really cool that you were there. So keep it up, my friend. Also, I want to give a shout out to the work that you're doing, you know, on YouTube leading up to these events inside the Octagon with Dan Hardy. I know the one that you did for 242, well over 1 million views. So you continue to impress with your work, and I wish you nothing but the best. And it was great to catch up.
Thank you very much. We're in Vancouver. You know, for those that like hearing the voice, Dan and I have got a decent run into Christmas.
Oh,
for
wonderful.
Those that don't, I'm sticking my tongue out and giving you the no. Unfortunately, you're going to have to deal with us on quite a few of these. I'm coming to Canada Ariel.
I love it.
Let me back in Canada.
I love it. I think they heard. I think they heard all the times that I was complaining. Not enough John Gooden in my life. So that's great. September 14th, Vancouver, Gaethje, Cerrone. What a great main event. That's great to hear.
I'm reporting for that one.
All right.
I'm reporting for that one.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to that.
All right, John. Thank you so much for doing this, and all the best to you and your family.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, and to you. Thanks again.
All right, there he is, the great John Gooden, one of the very best in the business at what he does, one of the best broadcasters. I'm a big fan of his work, and great to get his perspective on what happened last Saturday in China. Before we get to our next guest, of course, TST tells me to give a plug to Cheap Heat, our friends over there, a cheap plug, if you will. As you probably heard, Chris Jericho won the AEW title, and then he lost it at a restaurant. Corey Graves, who actually threw shade on me once, is throwing shade at Peter Rosenberg, my guy, that no good jabroni Corey Graves. And of course, WWE is coming back to MSG next week. A lot going on, as always, in the world of pro wrestling. All that and more on Cheap Heat with Peter Rosenberg. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's move along now to our next guest. Like I said at the top of the show, I first met this man in a mall in Abu Dhabi around 9.5 years ago. It was prior to UFC 112. They were hailing him as Mohammed Rogan, Mo Rogan, if you will. He was going to do the commentary in Arabic for the first ever UFC event in the Middle East. Here's a taste of that conversation 9 years ago. Ariel Helwani at the Marina Mall in Abu Dhabi just a couple of hours before the UFC 112 weigh-ins, and we run into Mohammed El Hosani, a.k.a. Mohammed Rogan, the color analyst for tomorrow night's event. Mohammed, nice to meet you. So tell us, how'd you get this gig being a UFC commentator here in Abu Dhabi?
First of all, thanks for coming here to Abu Dhabi and covering this event. I got the job basically. There was no auditioning process or anything. I was the only one who they approached. Basically, I've done grappling tournaments, jiu-jitsu tournaments mainly, and that's why and that's how they found out about me. So, it is my honor to work for the UFC after so many years, of following it on TV. It's like a lifelong dream. It's like a fan's dream. I'm a fan first and foremost. So it's funny that things end up that I actually sign a UFC contract and start working for the UFC. It doesn't happen to anyone else.
9.5 years later, he is the lead commentator for UFC programming on Abu Dhabi Sports TV. He's Mohammed Al Hosani. He joins us now from Abu Dhabi. Mohammed, salam alaikum. How are you?
Wa alaikum salam, man. It feels like deja vu.
It does. It's crazy, right? This time we're not in person. We're not talking face to face, but I thought it would be really fun to reconnect with you all these years later.
We looked younger back then, too.
We did. Yes, we did. it was nice. This week I've been reminiscing a lot about that first trip. Unfortunately, I'm not in Abu Dhabi, but, to have the UFC back for their first pay-per-view since then. Of course, they had the show in 2014, but this feels like a big deal. Wanted to get your insight into what it's like and how much the sport has grown since that show in UFC, at UFC 112, April of 2010. And it's so interesting that they're bringing Khabib there, because as I said at the top of the show, I think he's one of the most famous Muslim athletes in the world, but he is from Dagestan. He's not from the Middle East. So let me ask you this off the top. How popular is Khabib in the United Arab Emirates?
Man, I've never seen anything like this in the sport. What I've seen with Khabib is something I would see with Mo Salah, for instance. Mm-hmm. When he comes here and visits the UAE. Today we had the open workouts, and you could tell the guy didn't even work out. He just threw in T-shirts, like Real Madrid T-shirts, to the fans, and they went crazy. So I've never seen stuff like that, adult men going crazy for a fighter. Usually it's a football player, a soccer player, since we're talking to a U.S. outlet, but I've never seen it. I mean, even the media personnel, because I work with the media, they become less professional when they see Khabib. They want to take pictures and stuff like that. It's a weird situation, it's what I felt in 2010, the urge to take pictures with some of my idols. But again, to be professional, I have to stick to being the commentator, it's something that even though he's not Arab, it's still a big deal. People appreciate who he is and how he represents himself and his faith. And they love him even more after what happened in the last fight. So, yeah, the buzz is real. It's bigger than 2010, in my opinion, definitely bigger than 2014. And a lot of the mainstream are into the UFC now. They want to come and watch the fights. The tickets were sold probably a day or two since they were put on sale, and people are still looking for tickets. I mean, it's something for people that don't know, in the GCC, the Gulf, people are not used to, you know, pay-per-views and ticket sales when it comes to online ticket sales. So for tickets to get sold online like that, this is like unprecedented. You know, people were surprised because here people are still used to box office or going to a certain place and grab their physical tickets. It's not built the way it's built in Europe or in North America. So it's crazy times. You know, I don't really see this with any other sport other than football/soccer. So this is a big deal for the region.
Would it be accurate to call him one of the most famous Muslim athletes in the world today, from your perspective?
Definitely. I would say Muhammad Salah.
Yeah.
And Habib are the biggest two right now.
And the fact that he is not from the Middle East, the fact that he is Dagestani, do people, is that a point of contention at all, or do people not care?
Not at all. I mean, they see him as one of their own. Actually, some people even think he's Arab. I mean, they,
right.
You know, it's like, they love him. The guy is a lovable character, has been here many times before, even before he became, you know, as famous as he did after the Conor fight. He had training camps while he was injured in the Kingdom of Bahrain, who helped him, you know, get back to the sport after his injury. He came here several times. He had 2 weeks of his training camp here, and you know, people love him. He knows nobody's going to bother him here. The royal family takes care of him, makes sure that nobody bothers him with the media and stuff. The training camp, I mean, we tried to get into that training camp in Dubai, the NAS Nad Al Shiba training camp, which is a big time world class facility, and it was a no go zone. Nobody could enter except
wow.
the embedded cameras. So it was pretty private. They gave him his space, the best training facilities, and the guy's ready.
And is it sold out?
It's sold out.
Wow.
I mean, I'm trying to get tickets for... I heard some fighters when I was there for the... Because Abu Dhabi Sports TV had their own media day because they're the local broadcasting partner. I heard fighters asking for more tickets. Fighters on the card.
Mm-hmm.
So it is completely sold out, and there apparently are going to be a lot of high profile celebrities, whether it's political or sports or entertainment. It's a big deal.
How big was the Conor fight in that region, and could you tell that he became exponentially more famous as a result of what happened, and even the brawl afterwards? My theory is that made him even more famous. The fact that he was, honoring his family, his religion, all that stuff, that he was going out there and trying to defend the honor. Do you feel like all that made him exponentially more famous?
Unfortunately, yes. And I say unfortunately because a lot of bad things happened before that fight. I mean, I'm a pro wrestling fan just like you,
yeah.
Ariel, and I love that kind of stuff. But sometimes I don't like the whole religion political stuff when they go into that. I mean, you can say a lot of things, maybe family as well, because in certain cultures it's a red line. But, you know, Habib won, 26 fights before that?
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't as big in the region as he is after winning that Conor fight and the aftermath. You know, he jumped from, like a 1 million followers to 5 or 6 million, I think, on social media. So it is part of the way that things happen. You know, sometimes stuff like that needs to happen for someone to get famous. And yeah, after that fight, my WhatsApp blew up with, videos of that fight and Habib beating this, bigot. I'm sure Conor is not a bigot, but, that's how things kind of spiraled here with
right.
WhatsApp and social media. And it was from avenues that were not used to you know, even entertain, talking or sharing any MMA videos or photos. You know, it was groups of my friends who have nothing to do with MMA. It was, you know, it was like all over the place. It was even on the mainstream news. You know, our mainstream news does not cover MMA at all. You know, they cover boxing, maybe judo, but jiu-jitsu, obviously, but never MMA. So at that time, after that fight, for 1 or 2 weeks, there was nothing on TV but Habib, you know, and Conor McGregor. So, yeah, I mean, even though a lot of people don't like the way it was sold and the way, you know, the aftermath, but it made Habib who he is today. We have to admit that.
I saw a video of Dustin Poirier upon landing in Abu Dhabi. He was greeted by some locals and they started dancing. And I saw people saying like, wow. And it seemed like even Dustin was surprised. He was saying he's going into enemy territory. Of course, we know that Khabib is obviously very popular there. Were you surprised by that reception? And could you explain to us what exactly they were doing? What is that called? And why did they do that for Dustin, who clearly is not the fan favorite going into this fight in Abu Dhabi?
That's, you know, that's the Arab, you know, like the Arab homecoming, you know, like that's how they treat everyone. When you come to my home, that's how I treat you. Even if you're fighting, you know, a guy that's our friend, we'll still treat you with respect. And it's the Arab hospitality way. And I'm sure that people who visited a lot of Arab countries have witnessed at least some of that. And that's a traditional dance specific to people in the Gulf, more so the UAE, and it was amazing. You know, I always knew that was the plan, to do that for him, because of what he said in previous podcasts and interviews about him entering into behind enemy lines or all that stuff. But you know, he changed. After that welcoming ceremony, kind of, he changed his mind, and he saw, they put him in a nice hotel in the beachfront, and when I talked to him a few days ago, it seemed like he completely changed his mind on the whole thing. He doesn't believe it's you know, enemy territory anymore. He believes, he saw that there are more than 100 nationalities living in this country, and he will have a lot of fans too. So they are actually Arabs and Muslims rooting for him. So
really,
it's a sport, you know. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just because Habib is Muslim doesn't mean I'm going to root for him. I'm sure fans of Mohamed Salah, when let's say Man City, which is an Abu Dhabi team, plays Liverpool, I'll still support Man City, right? I'm not going to support Liverpool, even if Mo Salah is on that team. So it's kind of the same. I mean, it's a sport. But you'll be surprised. There are a lot of Dustin Poirier fans in the Arab world.
Yeah. No. I obviously know that as well. I thought it was a nice gesture. I thought it was great to see. It warmed the heart and a great way to start the week. I know the card has been criticized a little bit because if you look at it, there's a lot of Russian fighters on the card. There's not a lot of fighters who have ties to the Middle East. I think there's just one, correct me if I'm wrong, Bilal Muhammad, whose parents are from Palestine. Do you have an issue with this? Like, do you feel like they missed an opportunity to showcase some of the talent from the Middle East?
I'm a bit disappointed because I also covered and commentated for a lot of MMA promotions. After the UFC left in 2010, a lot of promotions popped up in the area. If you want to talk about the UAE, I could think of like three or four. And that's in the UAE, which is a small country compared to, you know, the US or Canada. So to have four MMA promotions in a small country is kind of a, you know, it shows how the UFC, when they came in, they tried inadvertently, to be honest, to create that grassroots movement, perhaps. But I don't think they were serious at the time. They came back in 2014 and did nothing as well, even though some of their executives at the time said, we will, you know, be serious about this. We'll try to build some fighters in the region. And, we'll get these fighters at the global stage. That didn't happen. It took four years for them to come back, or 5 years for them to come back again. Now they're saying the same thing, but they didn't add a lot. The only fighter I see as, you know, a serious gesture from the UFC towards what's coming up in the next 5 years in the region is Othman Azaitar, who is on the undercard. The first fight of the, you know, the I believe it's the FX prelims.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the only guy that came straight through from a Middle Eastern promotion to the UFC. I think, aside from Khalid Paha, who knocked out Boston Salmon in his last fight, and was supposed to be on this card, by the way, I do not understand how he was moved to the Australia card. Those two were the only guys that I used to commentate on local television in a regional promotion, and then, boom, all of a sudden they're in the UFC. So that gives me a good sign for the next 5 years, you know, that they're doing something at least. They're trying to bring up some of the guys that are familiar to the people here. So hopefully, I'm sure because Habib is on the main card, a lot of Russians are on there because I don't know if you know, but one of Abu Dhabi's first requests when they signed this deal is they told the UFC, listen, we will sign this deal, but the first year, the first event has to have Habib in the main event.
Mm-hmm.
So the UFC obliged, and Habib obviously wants his friends on the card with him.
Yeah.
And it is what it is.
I heard also that part of that deal was there had to be a couple of female fights on the card as well. Did you hear that too?
Yes. You know, Abu Dhabi is very big on making history, especially with female empowerment. We have a lot of ministers in the in government, you know, probably, you know, on par with any country in the world. Women empowerment is a big thing here in the UAE. Maybe a lot of people don't realize it because we live in a region that's always in, you know, like there's always issues, always bad news. When people in the U.S. listen about the news about the Middle East, it's usually bad stuff. But in here, we had the first WWE women's match not so long ago. And history was made even back then. It was a house show here in Abu Dhabi. So, at the time, I mean, it's 2014, there weren't any women's divisions in the UFC. So, they came back now, and women are back, and it's nothing out of extraordinary or out of the ordinary. You know, we want women's fights. Women's fights are exciting, and I think, you know, we've seen it in regional promotions anyway. So it's not like UFC isn't the first MMA promotion to bring women, but it's certainly the first time they bring women's fights to the UAE and Abu Dhabi.
Any concern on your part, or is there a sentiment out there that, you know, I saw you tweeted the photo of Khabib with his team. He's wearing the shades. He's become a lot more famous, as we discussed, that, you know, this is all a little too much. I don't want to say too soon, but that he is, you know, sometimes you become famous. Just ask Conor. You change a little bit, right? Things change. You approach fights differently. A boxer once said, you know, it's a lot easier to wake up when you're sleeping on the floor to go pound the pavement, to go run at 5 a.m., than when you're waking up in sand sheets. Do you get any sense that Khabib has changed, that the stardom has changed him and made him sort of take his foot off the gas pedal, if you know what I'm saying?
I mean, it has to change you. You have to be, I mean, this is, for me, the most interesting storyline in this fight are two things. The motivation that Dustin has over Khabib, because Khabib has reached superstar level. And I feel that maybe since his suspension, he's been doing the rounds. He went to Turkey. He went to Abu Dhabi. He's been going all over the world, you know, touring and stuff like that. I feel the motivation to fight maybe is less. He's probably going to kill me if he hears me saying this. But I feel like Dustin has more of a killer instinct in this fight. Khabib, when he became a superstar and he fought Conor, it seems like that's the peak, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know. I mean, now there's a lot of pressure on him, too, because I have his father is in his corner for the first time. We've never seen him under, you know, this much pressure. Like, can he handle this kind of pressure? All his family, his friends, you know, people, all like big name celebrities watching this fight. Like, I've never seen Khabib in this situation before. So it's like he's fighting at home. He's fighting, like, this is his Moscow or Dagestan card, literally, you know, this is his hometown fight. So this is what interests me, that storyline. You know, the pressure is on him, even though he's the champion.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel Dustin has nothing to lose. Dustin is in a win-win situation. He's fighting the best guy in the world. He's on the biggest winning streak of his UFC career. And, you know, this is a crazy sport, so let's see what happens.
So great to catch up with you, my friend. I really appreciate you doing this. His name is Mohammed Al-Hosani. He's the lead commentator for UFC programming on Abu Dhabi Sports TV. also does commentating for other combat sports, jiu-jitsu as well. And right now he has a show airing during this particular fight week called Abu Dhabi Showdown Week. So if you're listening in that corner of the world, do check it out. I wish you the best, my friend. Again, great to catch up. I'm sorry I couldn't be there and do this in person, but I really wanted to talk to you before this this massive event, and I appreciate you coming on so late over there in Abu Dhabi.
I wish you the best as well. I thank you again for having me on your show, and I look forward to seeing you hopefully in the next 4 years at least once or twice in Abu Dhabi.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you very much for the time. There he is, Mohamed Al-Hosani. He'll have the call over on Abu Dhabi Sports TV this Saturday. So we talked about Khabib. Now let's talk about Dustin Poirier. As I said at the top of the show, there was a documentary that came out in 2011 about the Louisiana fight scene, the regional scene, if you will. And one of the, pardon the pun, diamonds in the rough that they found was a young man named Dustin Poirier. It's a phenomenal documentary. In my opinion, it's one of the very best mixed martial arts documentaries out there, period. And if you have not seen it, it's the perfect primer for UFC 242. You have to watch this to truly appreciate what Dustin Poirier has accomplished to get to this point and how much he has overcome. Quick little taste of that, if you will. Take a listen to this from the Fightful documentary.
I definitely think fighting has opened the path to redemption for me. I mean, I've been in boot camp and juvenile detentions and programs and all this stuff that's supposed to help you. And I mean, that didn't help, you know. But when I found something that I wanted and that I really was going to chase, no matter what roadblock was in front of me, I would break it down and go get it. This is a picture of me right when I started training. I was probably about 200 pounds in that picture. Big transformation. Look way different, man. People like that haven't seen me since I look like that, like, don't even notice me sometimes.
He's finally found what he's been looking for all of this time. I know that he has been waiting his whole life to climb up something and put his hands in the air because he did it the best.
Can't stress this enough. You have to watch this documentary if you haven't before UFC 242. The director of the documentary, phenomenal filmmaker. He's very busy, but he's kind enough to give us some time out of his day. He's shooting right now, but took a little time out to talk to us about that film and about what Dustin Poirier has become. His name is Michael Tucker. Great to talk to him again after all these years. Michael, how are you?
I'm great. I'm really excited about this fight.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I really appreciate you doing this. Like I said, I know you're very busy. So let's start at the beginning. When did you first meet Dustin Poirier?
I think we filmed him the first time in 2009, and I think he was still an amateur. I might be wrong. Either it was his last amateur fight or his first pro fight. And by pro, that would be there was a local promoter there named Gil Guillory that put on something called USA MMA, sort of like in anywhere from like 2,000 to 5,000 seat arenas, both amateur and pro fights. And, you know, probably if it was a pro fight, Dustin's, you know, his show money was probably like $500 or something.
And when you found him, was it because, all right, I'm doing this documentary and this is a character that I want to chronicle? Or did you find him and then say, all right, this is a guy that I want to do a documentary and center? I know he wasn't the main character, if you will. There were several others. But, like, was it a chicken or the egg type of scenario?
Well, it started with sort of as a roundabout thing. You know, we ended up in this world, you know, via a soldier I was in Iraq with. I'd been, done some filming in Iraq, and this guy introduced me to MMA, and then he was fighting as an amateur. And he introduced me to this promoter, Gil Guillory, who was doing South Louisiana fights. And, it was sort of, you know, in a field, you know, on a fight night, there would be dozens of fighters. It was sort of like, you know, who do you pick? And, you know, I had shot some footage and I was watching it with my wife, Petra, who's also my co-director. And she was like, that guy sort of looks like he has it. I mean, he was young, he was good looking. He was charismatic, but he seemed so eager and like such a hard worker. And through, you know, almost 2 years of filming him, I mean, he always kept that ethos, you know, he never wavered. And so it really became that classic sports story, you know, I mean, what does it take to be a champion? You know, that's what really drew me into that world was him and his dedication, and watching him over the years, even when we were promoting the film and he was in the WEC and then, you know, finally in the UFC, just how dedicated he is and like how hard his training is. I mean, that is just an incredible story.
What was he like back then? Because I know when he started, he was like 200 pounds and in and out of juvenile detention and, you know, just kind of trying to find his way. What was he like towards you? And what was he like in the whole process? Because I would imagine for someone like him, you know, documentary, you know, where's the payoff here? 2 years, you're following me. Okay, like, is this a real thing? Like, what was that trust like between you and him?
I think his level of self-belief is so high. I think he knew he was going places. And it's sort of funny, from the other side of the camera, I was like, you know, is this really going to happen? In fact, I was just watching the trailer, the first trailer for the movie where, you know, the promoter, Gil Guillory, is like, well, you know, he, you know, maybe he could make it. You know, Tim Crater emailed me the other day and was like, you know, I always believed in him. And then Dustin, you know, he never gave up believing. And, you know, he had some setbacks along the way. But he also comes from, and I think it's also interesting about this fight coming up, both of these guys come from really interesting, pretty hard worlds, you know. They're a great matchup. And if Habib is a hard worker, I think Dustin is even more so a hard worker.
What is it like for a filmmaker to find someone like this is almost our version? When I say our, I mean mixed martial arts, our version of Hoop Dreams. But in a way, this is better than Hoop Dreams because your guy actually became a star. And Hoop Dreams, they didn't become NBA stars. For a filmmaker to find someone, like there's 12 fights on this card, you and your wife, you pick that one guy. And now 10 or so years later, he's fighting in a massive fight, could make history, could be the first guy to beat Khabib in Abu Dhabi and all this stuff. For a filmmaker, this must be unbelievable. This is like winning the lottery. Now here you are talking about it 10 years later. We can look back at that footage. Not a lot of fighters have that. And I've always said about Dustin that I felt like we have been emotionally invested in his journey, maybe a little more so than other fighters because of your film, because we saw his humble beginnings. You gave us that gift. So for you to see what he has become, what is that like for you?
Well, it's sort of been a mixed blessing. And I mean, we've known each other a while because, you know, you came out and did some stuff when we were showing the film. And one thing that was funny was that, you know, MMA was just really exploding then. I mean, the UFC was going mainstream. Ronda Rousey appeared. You know, this was even before Conor. And, you know, now the New York Times reports about MMA. Well, when that film came out, you know, it got panned by the New York Times. People were like, what is this brutal thing? You know, it's terrible. They're beating each other. And in our world, you know, of the world of film festivals and, you know, other documentary filmmakers, everyone thought it was sort of disgusting. You know, I mean, we fell in love with this world. It was like, this is the world of fighting. This is like the world of Joyce Carol Oates. I mean, this is this really romantic world about this thing that few people understand that is so beautiful. And we sort of embraced that. And Dustin was a great character. And so it's sort of been to watch him over the years go up through this, to see what it takes to actually stick with it and make it. It feels, I guess I kind of wish the film was coming out today, but, you know, what a great gift to follow someone like that. Cause it never happens. I mean, most of these stories end badly.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to be a champion. And I think that's really, I really attest to Dustin's will. I remember he went to go try out for, you know, the Ultimate Fighter. A friend of ours knew somebody and I think, you know, it was set up and, you know, they didn't take him, you know, the guy stuck with it the whole way through. I think it's amazing. You know, he's in Abu Dhabi. This is, you know, incredible.
And for you, you know, to see what he's become, I'm assuming just based off of what you're saying, like you followed his career, right? Like you didn't just finish the documentary and now are sort of catching up. You've stayed a fan. You've stayed in touch with him, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, stayed in touch. I mean, I've been to a few fights. I'm not sure have I been. I think the last one I went to was Korean Zombie, which I had to completely like hide my eyes. It's sort of like watching your brother or your son or something get pummeled out there.
Yep.
And I tend now when he fights, I'm always aware of it and I'll usually like tune it out until I know the results are coming in on Twitter. Cause it's just, you know, it's so hard. I mean, I feel so, so invested in him. It's been incredible to watch him. He's truly a good person. You know, he truly has worked hard for this and he's such a role model to so many people. And I think he's sort of put a really positive face on like on what a fighter, you know, can and should be.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the Korean Zombie fight. I remember being at that fight. I covered it in attendance in Fairfax. That was his first UFC loss, and I remember him losing the fight and then coming to us afterwards to talk about it, and he was very emotional. He was crying, and we all thought that maybe if he won that fight, he would, you know, he would get a title shot. So it was a massive setback for him, but you got to see his character, that he showed up, that he did the media. So that's one of those Dustin Poirier moments that I will never forget. I'm wondering for you, as far as making the documentary and seeing him in his early days, is there a memory that sticks out above the rest? Like, what's your favorite memory from making that film with Dustin and the rest of the cast of characters in Louisiana?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, again, I didn't know much about the world. I didn't know much about fighting and certainly about the personality of fighters. And what was amazing about him, even in tiny incremental steps, is seeing how he's made his life better and himself better. You know, everything he's done, he's sort of poured into his family, and, you know, he's set up a foundation. You know, he gives time to other people training. You know, he's just a really, you know, he's just like a really goofy, good guy. You know, I think he's, you know, he's not Conor McGregor, you know, he's not, but you know, he sort of talks with his hands, and I like that about him.
Did you ever think about doing a follow-up with him? Would that work, or does that not really fit what you were trying to accomplish?
I don't think, I mean, it certainly, well, in the universe of the UFC, that definitely doesn't work, because they're notorious about, you know, their rights to things.
Right.
So, I mean, for me, the best sort of sequel to this is watching exactly what's going to happen this weekend. I mean, win or lose, what a fantastic fight that's going to be. And I'm just thrilled. You know, I worked in Abu Dhabi for a while. I've been to that stadium. You know, it's great. The Emiratis are going to treat those fighters great. You know, it's a huge deal. I watched him arriving. I mean, what a show, you know. Of course, I would love to be there filming it, but, you know, that just didn't happen.
Will you watch it live?
I think I'm probably going to be out on my road bike, like, riding, like, tuning out the world. And when I can safely know that it's over, I'll go see what the result was.
Wow, you get that nervous.
I get super nervous. I mean, in fact, I knock on wood every 5 seconds, and I'm super superstitious about it. That's probably something I learned from him, you know, because he has all these little quirks about his superstitions. I never text him or email him or like wish, you know, anyone luck or not luck or, you know, break a leg. I just think it's just better to like just let him do what he needs to do, and then we'll know what happened.
Wow. I can't imagine if he wins. I would imagine as his career has elevated, he becomes more famous, that from time to time people do bring up the documentary too, that you sense sort of a spike in the interest. Does that happen, or do you feel like it was so long ago that there's a disconnect between Dustin today and Dustin of back then?
Oh, I think there's definitely a spike. And I think what's interesting, and again, about his character, is to see in it being such a classic sports story, here's a guy who really believes that he's going to make it, you know, but he doesn't just say it. He's actually sort of doing it. And I think that's really universal. And then, like you said about hoop dreams, you know, it's so rare that you see that play out in the world of sports. There's something really redemptive about that. And I think, as silly as it sounds, I'm going to be 53 years old, and Dustin's had a huge impact on my life, just knowing what's possible, you know, like knowing, like seeing via him, there are setbacks, you know, life does not always go as you want it to go. Just to see that he always goes back, you know, he's always in the next camp or whatever, pushing ahead. So, no matter what happens with this fight, I mean, Dustin, you know, has a long, you know, career ahead of him.
I'll tell you, my favorite scene in that documentary is the first time I was really exposed to this, watching him cut weight while watching the Food Network. I didn't know that fighters did that before watching it. It seems like he loves candy and things like that, and just watching him almost torture himself is a scene that I'll never forget.
Yeah, I mean, that's so funny down there also, is it's such a food place. And it's like, you know, people love to eat. I mean, it's such a big food culture. And I mean, Dustin definitely loves to eat. So like somewhere in that lightweight fighter is like, you know, a 250-pound man bursting to get out. I mean, to have that much self-control, you know, he probably just does it in a little dose. He's like, you know, I eat like a pig for 3 days and then I'm done. But yeah, the Food Network, all that stuff is hilarious. I think you remember the ice cream sandwiches from Walmart.
Yes.
You know, all these little things. So hopefully he'll find some in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. So great to catch up with you, Michael. I know you're very busy, so I appreciate you taking out some time. I remember my good friends over at Nomas who made that T-shirt in honor of the documentary when it came out. Remember that? Lazy Hands Will Bring Poverty. It's a great T-shirt. I still have it. And I still wear it, believe it or not.
I still wear mine all the time also. I'll be wearing mine on Saturday.
And, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm super excited for this fight. And, yeah, fans want to connect with the film. We tried to get it on most platforms around the world. So it's on iTunes. It's on Amazon. In most countries now.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. And again, I urge anyone who hasn't seen it, and even if you have seen it, watch it before 242. It will give you greater appreciation of who this man is and what he has overcome and what's he, you know, accomplishing to get to this point is really amazing. So congratulations again on a great film. I still talk about it all the time. I still admire it. And it was great to reconnect with you after all these years, Michael. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. There he is, Michael Tucker, filmmaker. Again, Fightville is the name of the documentary. One word, Fightville. Tim Crater, Crazy Tim, who sort of found Dustin way back when, is a character in the film. It's just a great look at the regional fight scene and how sort of down and dirty and circus-like it can be. But to find a guy who has now become a star in this sport and is on the cusp of making history is pretty amazing. It's truly like finding a diamond in the rough. And wouldn't you know it, his nickname is Diamond. How about that? So there you go. Before the show, I said this was my most anticipated episode. I think this was my favorite episode. The goal of the show is always, you know, I don't want to just talk about the same old, trying to find experts in the media. And I know we use the word reporters, but it's really, you know, people like Michael Tucker, people like Muhammad Al-Hassani, people who are experts in what's going on in the sport today. That's what I'm trying to do. It's sometimes easier. This week was an easy one as far as the topics and subjects are concerned. But each and every week we're trying to make the show as good and interesting and different as possible. I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did doing it. If you continue to like this show and the other shows that we're doing as far as audio is concerned, I urge you to rate, subscribe, comment, review, all that stuff and more. And I want to let everyone know that the Helwani Show is live on ESPN Radio on Thursday, tomorrow. We usually do a Saturday pre-pay-per-view show. Well, because it's in the afternoon, college football, we're doing a Thursday night show, 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio National. That's right. Taking your calls and your calls only, 9 p.m. Eastern tomorrow night, Thursday night, ESPN Radio National will be me and TST on the radio. We're going big time. For now, though, we shall say goodbye. Thank you very much to John Gooden, Muhammad Al-Hassani, Michael Tucker, and to all of you. Appreciate you listening. We'll talk to you Thursday night.